This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Alrighty, hour number two with you here on a Friday. Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio and CBS Sports Network. At Tiki Barber, at Brandon Tierney, at Tiki and Tierney. Coming to you live inside our Quicken Loans studio, national mortgage lender. Quicken Loans, apply simply, understand fully. Mortgage confidently. You guys are going to really enjoy this next conversation, and this is going to be a good hour. I mean, we try to make every hour really good, but I think this one's going to be really nice here with a fun baseball topic out of the shoot, and then Brandel Chamblee's going to stop by.
You're right.
There's a little showdown with Phil. Little showdown with Phil.
It's not going to be a showdown. He's going to take the high road.
No, he's not. You think he is?
I am.
Well,
we're going to give up. We're going to make him try. We're going to try to make him not do it, but yeah. I bet he does.
There are certain people who their delivery is such that they can diss you and it doesn't seem venomous.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's one of those guys. He'll defend himself for sure because Phil went low.
Yeah.
He basically said he created his career by denigrating others. If I'm Chamblee, I'm pissed.
That's just an opinion.
Well, true, but it's an opinion to react to.
Right.
You know what I mean? So we'll certainly. I have a nice conversation with Brandel Chamblee coming up. All right. Do you remember when we had the conversation?
Mm-hmm.
All right, you do. So back in March, let me just briefly reset this for everybody. Back in March, you might recall that the major and minor leagues combined to announce a new rule. I'm just going to read this throughout the minors here. Starting with the 10th inning, a runner would be stationed on second base, which seems very gimmicky. I get it. To begin each inning. While controversial at the outset, the rule has been warmly received by many fans and club personnel amid widespread skepticism that it may even translate to the bigs at some point here. And they messed around with this in the World Classic, the 2016 World Baseball Classic. Yeah, on the surface, certainly gimmicky here. And you're either, hey, this is kind of cool,
yeah,
and let's give it a shot, or this is the dumbest, dopiest thing I've ever heard.
Which just has to be your opinion.
No, it's the exact opposite.
What?
I love this.
Why?
I think it's awesome.
BT, this is not baseball. This is...
Well,
this
what is it then?
Well, I mean, it is obviously still baseball, but you have to earn what you do in baseball. Isn't that the point, right? I hear it all the time. People talk baseball is a game of failure, right? You can't just show up and be excellent. You're not going to hit 500 or 600. You got to fail a lot before you ultimately find success.
Yeah.
So by gifting in the 10th inning... a runner in scoring position, you're creating like opportunity that wasn't earned. I don't know if I love that. How can you love this? I just don't understand why this makes sense to you.
Okay, I'm going to incorporate the World Cup for a second here. We sit here. A lot of the game's been going on for the last month while we've been in studio.
True.
We watched 90 plus minutes, right? You get a little extra session there. And then if it's tied, they do something that doesn't even remotely represent what they did for the first 90-plus minutes of the game.
Yeah, at least they try.
Well, I mean...
They go to 30 extra minutes.
I mean, it's not like... Yeah. But it's not like baseball is... That's true. They do. And, well, baseball is giving you the... if it's the 10th inning, no. It wouldn't be akin to that. I hear you. But it's not like they say, all right, we're going to go in the parking lot and run the 40-yard dash to see who's going to get the fifth run and win the game. It's still... You still have to execute, man on second base. Do you drop down a bunt? Do you try to steal? Do you do a pinch runner, which further forces you to maybe at least on a very rudimentary level, kind of look at the roster maybe a little differently for when those situations arise? So we have a speed merchant there as our 25th man. I don't know. I'm just thinking
out loud.
But
then he doesn't score and he's got to go play.
Well,
you know what I mean?
You're not gonna listen.
I know what you mean.
You're gonna have a guy that can play defense and run.
And
then you do a double switch and you bat him maybe three innings down the road. And if you play 15 frames, or he's gonna hit eventually, or 13. But I mean, for the most part, if you score a run, you can avoid that. I just think that it's a real contradiction. While admittedly, it's wacky. I'm not here to tell you that it's not. It is wacky. It's flat out wacky, and it's nothing I've watched. 35 years I've been watching baseball. But I think that with the increase in Tommy John surgeries and the attention, this is really where I base a lot of my opinion on, medically.
Yeah.
We're doing everything in the game to circumvent, you know, players going to the operating table, to having that, you know, little part of the elbow sliced open, 9-inch scar, and a ligament transplant surgery. And if everything that we do about that, whether it's making sure there's an incremental, there's like a proper bump from A ball to double A, where you don't just jump excessively or recklessly, to pitch counts, to all the things that every organization does to avoid putting their players in position to have Tommy John surgery, I believe that doing this would assist in that effort.
Oh, I mean, of course it does, because we see what happens when these games go 17, 18 innings. You end up exhausting your bullpen, and then you get, you know, the left fielder coming out and trying to throw pitches.
It's been happening a lot lately.
It really has.
I mean, last year a couple times.
You're right. And I mean, it's interesting, maybe for a few pitches, is that to see. It's actually not what you want to see. You don't want to see somebody who's up there throwing 78 miles an hour.
You
know what I mean? Trying to get it across the plate.
That's terrible.
Trying to not to walk five guys and, you know, give up a run. It's not competitive.
No.
Right?
It's high school.
It's not even high school, because high school would be better.
Actually, bad high school.
You're right. It's almost you'd rather just end the game, end it in a tie, than watch 17 innings with, you know, position players trying to pitch. It's not that entertaining. You know, I had a friend that went to a game the other day down in Philly. I think it was a Yankees game. It was ridiculously hot, and it went into extra, and I think it went to like 13 or 14 innings, and it was exhaustive. And interesting, one thing that he talked about when I said, well, how was the game? I mean, it was pretty cool. I mean, it had to be a great game if it went that long. He said, they stopped serving beer.
Oh.
You know what I mean? It's like, you can't. You're stuck, and you could obviously just leave.
Yeah,
but you've committed yourself already. You kind of want to see it, especially if it's an important game. You want to stay to the end and say, "Oh, I saw them win and whatever." But they stopped serving beer in like the eighth inning or seventh inning, whatever it is.
That's right. That's probably a good thing, by the way.
Bottom of the seventh is when they stopped serving beer. So you're kind of sitting there.
Mm-hmm.
Like dehydrated, stuck.
Get some water. Alcohol makes you more dehydrated.
Of course
you know that.
You do. But it's better to hydrate with a beer. I'm just telling you.
Just drink Coors Light. That's water.
Exactly.
Basically.
So, I mean, there's so many other things that come into play when you talk about extra inning baseball. It gets really long and exhaustive. So if you can find a way to end it, I get it. But putting a guy on second base just doesn't feel like baseball.
Then you want to put him on first base? I mean, there's conversations to have. I mean, you can negotiate.
But
here.
How do you account for it then?
You just dump him on first base.
No, but how do you account for it in the record books? Right? How is this guy all of a sudden standing on second base?
If he's going to score a run.
Yes.
And, you know, Ricky Henderson, the all-time runs leader. That this guy's going to challenge that.
But I
hear you.
Maybe.
Literally, there's a percentage chance
that
this guy does.
You get a manager, you get a blazer, right? Guy who really can't play baseball that well, but he's fast as hell. Maybe
What was that? The A's pinch runner that they had? Finley did this in the 70s with the three championship teams. They signed a guy who ran like a 4.19, whatever the hell he couldn't play.
Yeah.
And this is Joe Rudy's team, Catfish Hunter, Reggie.
He was fast as hell.
I forget his name, but he was his only role. I think he hit maybe twice the whole year.
Wow.
His role, maybe I'm underselling that, but he was a pinch runner.
Yeah.
That's it.
So you get that guy, you stick him on second base.
Herb Washington. Thank you, Mike. I'm sorry.
Herb Washington.
Herb Washington.
So you stick Herb Washington on second base, and he starts just screwing up the statistics.
Screwing up the statistics. Yes, at some point there will be an impact in these scores in the stat column. But how many extra inning games does each team play per year?
Yeah, that's good.
I'm guessing maybe 9 on the average, maybe 10. So even if he scores 10 times,
the guy
would have to play 172 seasons to catch Ricky Henderson.
Okay, so then why do we even need this then? Is it really impacting that much?
You got to end the game at some point here, Tiki. Let me just, Mike, you've got the numbers, right? Because I want to further illustrate the arm issue. But the taxation of the elbow, I don't think it's just, I get it. Again, it's gimmicky, it's souped up, it's a little dopey. I'm with you. I'm not here to say it's the most incredible idea. But I don't think people realize, or if they do, I don't think they weigh it heavily enough or properly. So if you play an 18-inning game on Tuesday, okay?
Yep.
Do you know that the residue that carries for rest of the month?
No, you're shot.
It's really a competitive disadvantage. You know, like, I don't know. Like the Brewers, say if the Brewers do it on a or Sunday night to finish before they fly out to start a new series on Monday, and the Cubs get through a three-game set and they have no extra innings, and the Brewers play the Cardinals and Sunday night's a 19-inning game,
yeah,
and the Brewers exhaust their bullpen. I don't mean with position guys because it's a 3-2 game, real pitchers. They're shot Monday,
yeah.
They're shot Tuesday, and there's a chance some of those guys are shot Wednesday. So I just think that the carryover is not worth it.
Yeah.
Listen, I understand why people don't want to do this, but I think it's okay.
Now, did you watch the – you didn't watch it. Maybe you had it on because we're watching it right here now on television.
The tennis?
The tennis with the first semifinal, yeah, between Isner and Anderson from the Republic of South Africa. It went to the fifth set. It was 7-6, 6-7, 6-7. Then 6-4, then it goes into the fifth set, the deciding fifth set.
Mm-hmm.
And at Wimbledon, there is no tiebreaker. You have to win by two.
That's the only one of the four, I think, right?
What's the other one that does that?
No, three of the four do it. Three of the four doesn't is the U.S. Open.
The U.S. Open
does a normal tiebreaker.
They have a normal tiebreaker, so you can get out of it, mm-hmm, right? Eventually, it'll be 7-6. This thing, and when I first came in, I didn't realize what it was. I thought there was points that I was looking at.
Okay.
Right? They played 50 games.
How many hours did that encompass?
The whole match
like
was 6.5 hours.
How long were they on the court?
Fifth, 6.5 hours, the entire time.
It's a long day, man.
The fifth set took 3 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, so Sam threw, and this was
And that's not even the record. The record was 70 to 68. It was 11 hours, and it went 3 days.
Guys, right?
Same guy, John Isner, the American.
So here's the thing. It was one of our inbounds, out-of-bounds questions, and we didn't get to it.
No, we didn't have time.
It would have been interesting to get to it, because, and I guess we'll bring it up now here, mm-hmm, because Samter was like, how can you like this? It's got to end. But I'm not a regular tennis fan, mm-hmm, watcher. I mean, I'll go maybe once to the U.S. Open when it's here every, mm-hmm, other year, if that.
Mm-hmm.
But for the first time, and this is Wimbledon, right? We're not talking about whatever, the Phoenix Open.
Well, the Australia. Well, yeah, I see what you're saying.
You know what,
yeah,
I mean?
Gotcha.
Not a major. This is Wimbledon.
Yep.
Where we're talking. I've hardly watched any of this.
Yeah,
I sat and watched most of that fifth set, mm-hmm, just because it was interesting.
Yeah.
It was like 22, 23, 24. Is somebody going to get broken? And finally, a guy got broken. And we're talking about it. Mm-hmm. We'd be talking about Wimbledon if that hadn't happened. And so I think with Nishikori,
we would be if there were better names in it on the men's side.
Well, I mean, Isner's an American. I mean, he could be the next up and coming American man.
Really?
Absolutely.
To be the next.
He's tall. He actually looks a little bit like Andy Roddick.
How old is he? Because he did that a couple of years ago where he played for three straight days. He can't be a kid.
26? 27?
He's how old?
33?
Yeah, he's almost done.
He's been around for a bit.
He's still playing.
He looks young, even though he's...
Well, lucky for him.
But anyways, my point is, you're paying attention to him for the first time in Wimbledon. And I thought it was interesting.
No, I hear you. But if you didn't bring him up, I wouldn't have brought him. So basically, the comparison would be, like, to end it, since I favor this wacky solution for Major League Baseball, maybe not quite, but you'll feel me. Like, put a target out on the baseline,
uh-huh,
and the first one, they each get each one of them get like five serves, and whoever most directly hits the target advances. It's gimmicky.
Yes.
I understand what you're saying. I got it. Mike, real quick, did you have the number on the Tommy John surgeries through the decades? And
for the most part, I kind of just counted them by hand. There was no like one breakdown. In the 70s, there were two.
Mm-hmm.
In the 80s, there were 11. The first surgery was 1974.
Of course.
So that makes sense with two in the 70s.
Now, this doesn't mean that people didn't actually tear their UCL.
Correct.
Oh, they did. Their careers were over.
Correct.
Oh, yeah.
11 in the 80s, 47 or so in the 90s.
Boy, that's amazing.
I couldn't count the 2000s, but there were over 200 so far in the 2010s. So I'm assuming somewhere around 150 in the 2000s
that's
or something
amazing.
Like that.
And that's just in the major leagues?
Yeah.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Like, listen, to BT's count, to counterpoint BT, like you said, there's not a lot of extra inning games that go past 12, 13 innings that you would need this rule anyway. I don't know how much this is really going to help arms. I mean, maybe 10, 15 games a year. Total.
Well, if it helps one arm, it's worth it.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, you have long relievers, and especially when you expand rosters. I mean, is it really like, is some guy pitching like 10 extra innings? No, you just throw in an extra guy for an extra inning. And there's all pitch counts, so you're not like overusing guys, really. You're just using more guys.
Yeah.
And maybe you're using like Mark Reynolds to pitch after his 10 RBI game.
That was amazing. All right, we got Brando Chambly coming up. By the way, if you guys want to weigh in on the baseball conversation about the quirky rule that, I don't know that it's imminent, but it certainly gained A little momentum here, and certainly more favorably received than we thought when it was than many thought when it was first announced back in March that they would experiment with this. Phil Mickelson versus Chamblee, our buddy. I'm going to talk to Brandon coming up next right here on Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio.
Summer is here, and so is the unbearably hot weather. Think about how much time we spend in the sun over the summer. We also spend a lot of time in our cars during the summer months. You know how that heat can just drain the life out of you? Well, imagine what it's doing to your car. Summer heat can be draining on your vehicle's battery, even more so than the harsh winter months. Heat, more than cold, can shorten your battery's life. Rising temperatures can cause battery fluids to evaporate, leading to corrosion on cable clamps and terminals. You always want your car at its peak performance, so stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts now and have your battery tested free of charge. That's right, free of charge. And if it needs replacing, the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts will help you find the exact SuperStart battery that fits your car or truck at a guaranteed low price. To find a store near you, visit O'ReillyAuto.com. That's O'ReillyAuto.com. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices. Every day.
It's a venomous song. He's just spitting anger here.
Yeah, he is.
Okay, CBS Sports Radio's toll-free line is 855-212-4227. Brought to you by Geico. Great news. Quick way to save money. Switch to Geico. Geico.com. Go there, and in 15 minutes, save 15% or more on car insurance.
Knowing our board op, I bet he played this. Simply because he knows that we're trying to start a fight here.
Yeah, a little method to what he does back there. Although I do not think that the classy Brandel Chamblee is going to start spit. Although he might. I don't know. Listen.
Do us a favor.
Hey, if somebody said that I made my career by denigrating others, I'd be a little bit pissed off. So let's by the way, he's in Scotland. He is in Scotland right now. Playing St. Andrews, and a good friend of the show.
Sucks to be you, too.
Brandel. It's terrible, right? Nobody breaks down the golf swing like Brandel Chamblee. He is just the numbers, the angles, the data, the metrics. He's really on point. He's a great follow on Twitter as well. Brandel, Tiki, and Tierney, welcome back to the show, buddy. What's happening?
Nice talking to you guys. I'm in St. Andrews. It's no better place to be in the world. I had a fun day in spite of the fact I don't think I denigrated anybody today.
Nice.
I was playing golf.
Nice.
I think I had a pretty good day for me.
Well, what did you shoot there, buddy?
Were you harsh on yourself?
Yeah, I was very harsh on myself. I shot a really smooth running 75. I don't think that's going to get that done. I'm going to have to get a little better if I expect to qualify for the Senior Open.
I love that you're putting yourself out there, man. And we will certainly circle back to that before we hang. I love it. That now,
right.
I think it's awesome. I think it's for those who don't know, Brandel's getting back on the courses and he's playing again. Okay, so the comments by Mickelson. Teak and I spent a good segment on it yesterday. What was your first? I know you put something on Twitter, but what was your initial reaction? Were you surprised at all? What was your first thought when you read that?
Well, my first thought was that it's coincidentally on the heels of his sort of bizarre actions that he's not too happy with some of my comments. You know, I think I got into TV in 2004. So from 2004 to 2014, I think every time I would have talked about Phil Mickelson, it would have been laudatory to the nth degree. But beginning in 2014, specifically at the Ryder Cup, when I would say he denigrated Tom Watson and I think detracted from what should have been a great celebration for the European side and Paul McGinley, that I probably didn't have very many nice things to say about what Phil did in the media center, disparaging Tom in Scotland. And from then, you know, periodically, as it's related to the Ryder Cup, I've had some critical things to say about Phil. And then on the heels of the most bizarre thing I think I've ever seen a legend do at the U.S. Open. So, you know, I just thought it was, you know, it was fitting that, you know, he would have disparaging things to say about me. But my job is really, you know, I mean, you guys know my job. I mean, my job is to analyze and critique the best players in the world. And the nature of human beings is they remember negative comments. They don't remember all the good things you say about them.
Yeah, what are the good things about Phil? Because there's got to be plenty.
That's a great short game.
Of course, right? We see the flop shots. We see the ridiculous things that he does.
Yeah, but I've said for years that Phil's a gift to the game of golf because you couldn't ask for anybody who takes more chances. You know, there was an Arnold Palmer sort of flair to the way Phil played the game. He won often enough where, you know, you could depend on him winning 2, 3, 4 tournaments a year. And he lost tragically. He won heroically. And he was usually pretty gracious with his time with the media. So there are a lot of great things about Phil. I mean, the game's been very exciting with Phil Mickelson in the game. He's proved to be a pretty good foil. I would never call him a rival to Tiger Woods, but he was a pretty good foil for Tiger Woods. So
yeah,
he's made the game far more interesting than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, totally agree. Brandel Chambliss with us here on Tiki and Tierney. You know, Phil, at one point when the and a foil is a great way to phrase it, because rivals probably giving Phil a little bit, much like VJ and David Duval, a few others for a minute, they were in Tiger's path, and then it just stomped all over him before he got hurt. Nobody really stood up to Tiger. We know that historically. But I've always been a Phil guy. And there was a point, Brandel, where you had to make a choice. You're either Tiger or you're Phil. And I went to Phil quickly. I play left-handed. I love his style, you know, going for it. And when you go for it, sometimes it's going to be brilliant, mm-hmm. and sometimes it's going to be brutal to watch. And I appreciate the humanism in his game. But I got to tell you this, because I know you and I interact on Twitter a little bit, and I think that you know that I know the game a little bit. And I know people within the game. And I know people within the game. The public Phil is very different from the private Phil. Can you expound on that, or am I wrong with that?
Well, I mean, the public loves Phil, that's for sure. But there is an edge to Phil, you know, and he is he's working an angle. He's a smart guy, you know. If he doesn't like an architect like Reese Jones, he'll make, you know, snide little comments about Reese Jones. If he doesn't like the way a tournament's run, he'll make comments. If he doesn't like the FedEx Cup, he'll make comments about it. I'm pretty sure that's why there's a week sort of sabbatical in the middle of the FedEx Cup. I'm pretty sure the reason that the WGC match play has round robin is because Phil was fairly vocal about it. You know, Phil's a powerful guy in the world of golf, and if he doesn't like something, he's pretty quick to say it in however way he can say it. And pretty soon after it, he can direct change in the game of golf. So, you know, the people that can be influenced in the game of golf listen to Phil because, you know, he's a powerful guy. He's a bright guy. But there's a Machiavellian nature to him. And, you know, as affable as he can be when fans are around, he could be a tough guy.
You know, Brandel, you came on, you know, I think you said 2004 is when you first started doing television. So it's been 14 years. And I think in that 14 years, the viewing audience of golf has changed and it's evolved a little bit. Like BT was talking about when we had this discussion yesterday, how golf is, you know, a gentleman's sport and, you know, it's got to be it's snobbish, or sometimes analysts can come off as snobbish. But when you think about who's watching golf right now, don't you have to be critical, but also very exuberant in praise as well? Because like the boring, you know, Stead, oh, you know, that was a great shot by him, don't you think? That doesn't work anymore, right?
Nope. Boring.
Well, by the time I come on the air, by the time our show, you know, Live From, comes on the air, you think about it. I mean, the golf's been on in the morning. Mm-hmm. There's usually a morning show.
Yeah.
There's 8 hours of golf, say, at a major championship. Everything that could possibly be said about golfers or golf shots, you'd think would have been said.
Yeah.
So our challenge as we sit there all day long is to think, what hasn't been said? What can we tell the audience that is not obvious? So, our audience is very knowledgeable. They don't watch this game sort of obliquely. They're all in on it, and they're watching it for themselves to get better. And they are all in on the stats. And so, you have to dive in deep. Our audience is knowledgeable, and that's our job, is to watch it and to be as critical as we can and to dive as deep as we can into the statistics and the analysis and the swing, and then share it in an impactful way. And most of the time, it's pretty good-natured stuff because it is just golf.
Yeah, and here's the episode of Brandel Chambliss, of course, Tiki and Tierney, CBS Sports Radio. Brandel's out in Scotland just wrapping up St. Andrews, 75. We've got to get a little bit better on the green there, Brandel. Shave a few strokes off, buddy. You know what I mean?
That's said with the utmost jealousy, Brandel.
100% jealous. I'd take a 75 on the local muni. But, you know,
The gentleman I was playing with, though, holed out on the 18th hole.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah, he did. And then, you know, there's a pretty big crowd, so everybody was cheering. And we walked up there. Ernie Els was on a balcony overlooking the green. And And he was like, who is this guy you were playing with, Brad? And I said, there's at least one person in the group that can play. I know that. So it was a great moment for him.
I hope he bought you a beer. I hope he bought you a beer and everybody else won as well.
They're drinking. They're drinking. Speaking of holding out, Rich, Brandel, Rich Lerner's show the other night was phenomenal on the Golf Channel about Van de Velde's. Did you get an advanced copy? Get a chance to see that? Because I wanted to run something by you there.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the great things, you know, is that we, I love Rich, you know, and I just dive in deep on his, you know, essays. So yeah. I watch his stuff. My wife loves to read. So we'll come back and his turns of phrases are great. His way to dive into a story is great. So yeah, it was tremendous.
Okay. So what I didn't know,
John Van de Velde is amazing.
Yeah, and he listen, he's such a dignified guy, and he seemingly has recovered very well from one of the, you know, he seems like he's in a good place. What I didn't know, though, because that's when I was just getting into golf, I didn't know that Laurie said to Jean, hey, right as he was melting down when they were both in the bunker on 18 at Carnoustie, hey, compose yourself in so many words, I paraphrase, take your time, if you want me to go, I'll go. And then the guy holes out. Talk about amping up the pressure. I did not even realize that that happened. How crazy is that?
Right. And, you know, actually, when I was watching it and I saw Van de Velde make the putt for triple bogey, and no one's ever reacted so animated after making a putt for triple bogey. But I thought he thought that he had won it. I thought that he had lost track of the score. So I thought there's no way he has that reaction. You know, it happened almost 20 years ago, and we're all sort of still spellbound by what we saw. And there were so many mysteries. What I'd love to see, you know, is exactly the railing and a slow motion video of that ball. I mean, it was just such a terrible break, and the guy gets so much grief for what people will say is a dumb play. And it was like, no, it was the worst break in the history of golf, hitting that railing.
Totally.
Yeah.
He would have gotten a free drop.
Yeah, you're right.
He would have gotten a free drop, and you know what everybody would have said? What a brilliant play it was. It's like, you know, the difference between success and failure, you know, the difference between called being brilliant and a dumbass is just whether or not it comes off.
Yeah,
and,
true.
That's
and
very true.
Everybody likes to say, oh, you know, he went down like a Frenchman, whatever that means, and, you know, it was a stupid play. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's the worst break in history.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good point. Hey, Brandel, before we let you go, we keep hearing these rumblings of this $10 million match between Phil and Tiger. Is it a good thing, or is it too contrived?
Well, I think it'll get an audience, certainly. I mean, you guys are historians. Y'all probably remember the Shell's Wonderful World of Golf. It had a nice run. People still talk about Sam, Steve, Matt Hogan playing each other back in the mid-60s, which eventually led to the PGA Tour champions. It did. It led to that tour because of the popularity of that little get-together. So, you know, the Phil-Tiger thing, if you think about it, it never really happened with the exception of one week at Doral.
Yeah.
You know, back I think around 2005, they had a good go. Phil almost chipped in on the last hole to tie Tiger Woods, and that's it. So all those rivalries that we wanted to see between Tiger and Phil, it never happened. So everybody's still hungry for Tiger Phil against each other. Yeah, the problem is they actually like each other now. So
they
don't have the animosity that we would like to have between the two. And then, you know, Tiger Sergio, yeah, I think that would be pretty interesting. But Tiger Phil right now, yeah, I think people will watch it. You know, but it would mean nothing. I mean, you know, we already know who the best golfer is, and on any given day, Tiger can beat Phil, or Phil can beat Tiger, and you know, it would mean nothing. It would just be about entertainment.
And they have more.
You know, they're no longer at their peak anymore.
And they both have more money than God, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's like a $5 Nassau for me and Tiki for those guys. It's not even their money though.
When Hogan and Snead played, it was $3,000 to the winner and $2,000 to the loser.
That's amazing.
$1,000 difference. Wow. I mean, a lot of them.
God. All right, so in summation, Brandel, because everybody driving around, and I'm sure this will get a little play nationally here, you bump into Phil on the range at the next event. You walk by him, you shake his hand, what happens? He is a black belt, by the
Phil
way.
Phil and I have a lot of the same friends. You know, some of his best friends are some of my good friends. So we have a lot of mutual friends. And I'd say, hey, Phil, how are you? Good to see you. You know, Phil's not one of those guys that is abrasive face to face. You know, he would like to sit down and you know, if I saw him, I'd say, first of all, La La Land was a terrific movie.
That's good. Yeah, that was in the article. Yep, I got you. That was good.
First of all, La La Land was a terrific movie. I think you've lost your mind that you think that was a bad movie. But just because it didn't have a happy ending, you know.
Yeah.
Second of all, you know, what's your beef, and what do you think is denigrating about what I've done specifically? You know, my job is to analyze most of the time, and I could get Phil a tape, and I promise you, I could get him a 10-hour tape of me going on and on and on about how good he is for the game of golf.
I've heard it.
You know, I think he was a little hyperbolic there, and I think I would you know, clearer heads would prevail.
Mm-hmm.
I think I could convince him of that.
Okay, and then he gives you a karate chop to the temple, and Brandel hits the deck, and he's a black belt, and so you better be careful. Hey, listen, I know you haven't done a lot of interviews since this, so we appreciate you calling in from Scotland. Really good stuff, Brandel. Thanks for hopping on, buddy.
Yeah, happy to. Always enjoy talking to you guys. Look forward to watching the Open next week. Give me a shout.
No doubt, buddy. We will do that. Thank you. A little late, worth it. Axe update right now. Here's Rich. All righty, football, the 40s coming up here in a second on Tiki and Tierney. That Chambly stuff was really good. Time, though, for a game preview brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings. So they say soccer's the football of the rest of the world. Catch all the soccer action at Buffalo Wild Wings, where they've got select domestic beers for every single match. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports, offers vary. All right, so tomorrow morning, Serena Williams going to take on Germany's Angelique Kerber in the Wimbledon women's finals. Serena trying to win her 8th title at the All England Club and her record-tying 24th Grand Slam overall. By the way, how the heck was she ranked 25th coming in? She was seeded 25th, right?
Yeah, it's because she missed time because of her pregnancy.
I don't care. She just didn't play.
I agree.
If she's in the third trimester. She should always be number one.
I 100%. 25th? At the very worst, top three.
Yeah.
I hear
it's ridiculous. Kerber trying to win her 3rd Grand Slam, by the way, and first at Wimbledon. She lost to Serena back in 2016, so a little rematch there.
Yeah, she had a super year in 2016. She won 2 majors that year, or for 2 Grand Slams that year, I should say. But then she got to the final of Wimbledon.
Yeah.
So great 16. She just finished 2nd at Wimbledon.
It's got to be so deflating trying to beat Serena. When she's on,
it's
night and day.
I mean, she's superior athletic.
Varsity versus JV.
Most times.
Actually,
it feels
varsity
like
versus freshman.
Yeah, it feels like that sometimes.
Physically, right?
I think she destroys Kerber in this one. Just based on their games. Nothing about either one of their skill set, but just based on how they play the game.
Look at you breaking it down.
You just study it a little bit. You watch her a little bit. You realize.
You're a sneaky tennis fan over here. I like it.
Not really.
No, you're filling in some holes I don't know about. No, good job. Seriously.
And it'll be awesome, too. She just had a baby. So what? This is her 4th, right? Sam, I can't remember if it's her 3rd or 4th
event
back. I think it's her 4th since she had the baby. Serena. It's her 4th event back, I think it is. One, she pulled out because of injury. But this one means a lot. You know, these are the ones that you tick on your resume, nobody beats you.
Oh, yeah. What was your biggest takeaway before we get to football at the 40s from Chambly? What really jumped out?
One, how calm he is in the face of a controversy, but also how he would solve it. Just address it.
Mm-hmm.
I respect guys like that.
Yeah,
they don't run away from whatever the issue is. They address it.
One thing I didn't know, you ever see the guy, the former caddy, Michael Smith? He's on ESPN. He's got a beard now.
I don't
want to say he's heavy, but, you know, a big, you know, like a thicker guy and a bald-shaved head. He's great. He's funny. You guys ever see him? I guess as I was doing some research on the Chambly Phil stuff, something popped up, and I didn't know this, that Smith and Chambly almost had a fist fight.
What?
2 years ago.
On air?
On the range.
Oh, wow, okay.
So Chambly likes to ruffle a few feathers, although I don't think it's intentional.
I think he just tells
it
like it. I think he's just honest, exactly.
Love it. All right, Tiki, ready for football at the 40s?
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's roll.
40-yard kick, right hash mark.
40 yards on the return.
A 40-yard touchdown.
40 yards.
You love football. We love football. So we give you football every day. It's Football at the 40 with Tiki and Tierney on CBS Sports Radio.
All righty, here we go. So Tim Tebow has weighed in on Baker Mayfield and what he thinks is going to be with the Browns here, and it's very positive here. So If you like Tebow and you believe in the good vibes that this might provide Browns fans or their team, this is probably a good thing. Quote, I'm friends with Mayfield. I think he's going to do a nice job. I think he's really focused on trying to prove that he was worth it. I really think Baker is somebody who's pretty special. I think that the way he can play, the way that he can lead, the it factor, he's got it.
Yeah, no, I think he's right. There is an it factor there. We felt this when we met Baker Mayfield at the Super Bowl when he came and had a conversation with us. You just see how he carries himself. He's got a confidence about him that's infectious. You know, one of the hardest things for quarterbacks to do is earn the respect of guys older than them in a locker room and particularly in a huddle. I think that comes naturally to Baker Mayfield, obviously because of where he came from and where he grew from and the fact that he was always the underdog and, you know, the first non-scholarship player / walk-on to ever win the Heisman Trophy. Those things matter because it shows that you can get it done regardless of the circumstances.
A little more from Timmy. He says, Baker's got the fire. Baker's got the spark. Doesn't let the pressure of everything else get to him. And that would be one piece of advice. Just go out and make football the main thing. Go out and play like he's done for the last 5 years. I think you and I agree. Maybe it might take a little time to transition. We are, I don't know if we're rolling on Baker Mayfield, but we'll put some chips in the middle of the table, defending him. We like him.
No doubt.
All right. After a fantastic inaugural season in the CBS booth, Tony Romo with, let's face it, a way too early Super Bowl prediction, but we'll take it anyway. Who do you think he rolled with here?
I know who you rolled with.
Pretend you don't. Just throw out a couple of teams.
I'm going to say the Giants and
the Packers and the Jaguars. And I'm going to disagree vehemently with Tony. On this one, on the Packers.
Really?
That defense
they're horrible. Yeah.
Is not getting out of the NFC.
I think their offense is good enough to carry them through the North and maybe win and get to the postseason.
Maybe the Vikings.
Well, the Vikings. Yes.
Vikings are pretty good.
I agree. Their defense is great.
Yeah.
We need to see if Kirk Cousins from Washington advances Kirk Cousins in Minnesota. I think the answer is, they have a pretty good run game. I think everything will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they do get into the postseason based on who they play in the NFC North. But the Jaguars are the more interesting one. And if that's sneaky or not, we know that it depends solely on whether Blake Bortles can take that next step. We know he's taking incremental steps and he's on his plateau right now that's been good enough, but not good enough to take them deep. Because they couldn't trust him, right? They just basically sat on the ball at the end of the game when they lost to the Pats. But they did sign Austin Seferin Jenkins this offseason.
So I wanted my Jets to keep him.
I agreed. But there's another weapon for them. And you know how I love tight ends, BT, for either young or non-superstar quarterbacks. Uh-huh. That could be the X factor.
Okay. Statistically, real quick, on the Jaguars, fifth in the NFL in offense, 26 points a game. And second, we know the defense is terrific, and it was a year ago, and if they can replicate that, they're in great shape. But 5 points per game, a lot of people might not realize that because of all the shade, and understandably so, that Bortles has received. But they put some points up, so we shall see. Speaking of the Jaguars, I don't know if it's the most unique take, but it's interesting. Blake Bortles says the Jags won't sneak up on anybody in 2018. And let me ask you this here. I mean, is there really something, because when the Jaguars, the Giants are a team that always commands respect, even on a down year, they're the Giants. And the Jaguars really, for a long time, have been the complete antithesis outside of Tom Coughlin's first run when he had Keenan McCardell and Jimmy Smith and Brunell. Do players really get wrapped up in, perennial doormats, this is going to be easy? Does that really happen when it's one game a week in the NFL?
No, not really. I don't think, because you know that you probably know somebody on that team and either played with them or know about them. And at the end of the day, you realize in a game as physical as football is, even the best teams can lose. It doesn't always happen, and it's rare, but even the best teams can get snuck up on if they're a little bit off their game or just get hit in the mouth wrong. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, I think your instinct is right.
Here's the quote, by the way, from Bortles. I think last year we kind of caught some teams by surprise, if that's possible in the NFL. I don't think that's something that's going to happen this year. The way we play, as good as our defense is, I think we're definitely a bit on people's radars now as far as a team that's headed in the right direction and a team to be taken seriously.
I think the problem with the Jaguars last year and what he's alluding to is nobody thought that offensively they could beat you. They knew that defensively it would be a struggle. But, hey, we got to score a touchdown or two, and we win.
Yeah.
They didn't realize that Leonard Fournette was a game changer, not only as a runner but as a receiver as well. He had a bunch of catches last year. He gets underappreciated.
Remember that run he had against Pittsburgh?
Yeah, exactly. So they had game changers, and it didn't feel like it because you look at paper and you're like, yeah, their offense is okay. But then they beat you, but they scored three touchdowns. And all of a sudden, you can't catch up because their defense is so good.
This is embarrassing. Ray Lewis, remember the story in the Times?
Yeah.
Where some players and people were exposed for buying Twitter followers. Ray Lewis apparently, I guess Twitter's begun purging some of these fake accounts. He went from, in one day, 712,000 followers to 364,000.
Wow.
How pathetic is that?
Basically lost a quarter of a million followers. Quarter of a million.
Who buys Twitter? I guess Ray Lewis does.
Britt McHenry did as well. She lost about...
From ESPN.
About 150,000 or so Twitter followers. What's the point?
What does it even cost?
I have no idea. But whatever it's worth, I mean, is it really worth it?
Evidently not.
Yeah, people do it because it gives you higher influencer status.
Sure, it gives you perceived reach.
Yeah, you're going to reach more people, but it's nonsense.
All right, T. Coming up, Isaiah Thomas went from borderline MVP with the Celtics to no longer wanted in Boston, to dealt to the Cavs, to not wanted there. Veteran minimum. Can he revive? And are the Nuggets maybe better than the Lakers? Next.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.